Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Skip Rhodes, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Directors and your chair for today's program. And I'm now pleased to introduce today's speaker. He's a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley and co-author of the new book, Taming Globalization, International Law, the U.S. Constitution, and the New World Order. During the administration of President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2003, our speaker served as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he worked on issues involving foreign affairs, national security, and the separation of powers. During this time, he wrote the administration's first decisions on prisoner detention, habeas corpus, military commissions, and the Geneva Conventions. He received much attention for writing controversial memos on the treatment of prisoners. He also previously served as general counsel of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee from 1995 to 1996. He originally joined the Bolt Hall faculty at UC Berkeley in 1993 and then clerked for Justice Clarence Thomas of the U.S. Supreme Court. Our speaker has received research fellowships from UC Berkeley, the Olin Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation, and is a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. In addition to his latest book, Taming Globalization, he is the author of The Powers of Price and Peace, The Constitution and Foreign Affairs After 9/11, War by Other Means, An Insider's Account of the War on Terror, and Crisis and Command, The History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush. He also received his JD from Yale Law School and his BA in American History from Harvard University. Please give a generous Commonwealth Club welcome to Professor John Yu.
I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for asking me to return to speak about Taming Globalization. I was last here 2 years ago, I believe, to speak about Crisis and Command, and I had a wonderful time then. I'm glad to be back again. I'm also very honored that the Commonwealth Club invited Judge Abraham Sofayer to moderate, question, and comment on the book. I couldn't imagine a more qualified and acute commentator. I don't know whether he'll agree with anything or some of it or much of it, but I really look forward to his comments and questions. It's a great honor, actually, to have someone with his combination of academic experience. He was also a judge, and he was also a legal advisor at the State Department. So every job I've ever had in my career, he did me several levels better, in fact. So I look forward to his comments and questions. I also would be remiss if I didn't mention my co-author, who's not here, Julian Koo, who's a professor at Hofstra Law School. And the origins of the book are that Julian and I actually went to a conference together, and just by chance we gave papers that said almost exactly the same thing, just by chance, and that became the genesis for this book. So let me just briefly describe a case of Medellin versus Texas and explain how that, to me, encapsulates a lot of the issues in Taming Globalization. Now, Medellin versus Texas is a case of a Mexican national who crossed the border and committed murder, a capital murder, and was sentenced to death by the state court in Texas, state courts of Texas. He was not, however, given his warnings under the Vienna Conventions, which require that when an alien is arrested in the United States, he be given warnings that he can seek access to his consulate, that he can get assistance from translators, and so on. Texas refused to reconsider its decision, even though it had not provided these warnings as required by a treaty. The country of Mexico went to the International Court of Justice to seek relief, saying that the United States had violated its treaty obligations. The International Court of Justice found against the United States and said the United States had, in fact, violated our obligations under the treaty, and issued an order to the United States to halt the execution of Mr. Medin and the other aliens on death row in the United States who also were in the same situation. President Bush issued an order to the governor of Texas. I trust he knew the address to put on the letter. President Bush issued an order to Governor Rick Perry asking him, effectively ordering him to stop the execution so that the United States could come into compliance with the Vienna Convention and the International Court of Justice's decision. Texas refused to obey it and actually was sued in the Supreme Court. And ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to stop the execution. Mr. Medin was executed there shortly thereafter. And in that decision, the Supreme Court said that even though the United States had signed the Vienna Convention that required these kinds of warnings, that Congress still had yet to do something. Congress had to act to put it into effect. And until Congress did that, the courts were not going to get into the business of enforcing the treaty, even in a death penalty case when someone was right on death row. In many ways, that one case, and it's very complicated, but that one case summarizes a lot of the issues in this book. The first is that globalization, although we use the phrase a lot, has caused a lot of changes in our political and legal system. And when we say globalization, we mean a few things. One is the easy and rapid and cheap movement of goods, capital, and people across national borders. So, for example, in the United States, millions of aliens cross our borders every year, coming in and out of the country. Billions of dollars of goods and services also cross our borders. In the last, I think, the economic report of the president a few years ago, 30% of American gross national product is either related to imports or exports. And, of course, billions of dollars move with the press of a button between accounts here and abroad. Globalization also refers to, I think, the ease of communications and the rise of the internet and the creation of new kinds of networks that make it extremely easy and cheap for people to communicate and for things abroad to affect us here at home in a way they didn't used to 50 years ago or even 25 years ago. So if you look today at the American stock markets, they move up and down in reaction to what's happening in Greece. Whether Greece is going to be able to pay back its bonds has a direct and immediate impact in the same day on the Dow Jones. That's something that probably wouldn't have happened 30 years ago or 40 years ago, but the speed and quickness and cheapness of communications makes that possible. However, we'd be the first to admit that globalization is not an undiluted good. Globalization also makes bad things possible. So, for example, transnational criminal networks, drug smuggling, pollution crosses state borders, terrorism crosses state borders. In fact, a lot of these problems use the same channels of international commerce and communication to move around the world just as goods, capital, and people do. That has sparked, I think, in our view, a response, which is to try to create regulatory regimes that control these new types of globalization. We call it in the book global governance, but people refer to it as many different things. But the basic idea is that it's outside the power of a single nation state to effectively regulate any of these things anymore. It used to be within the power of one country to affect most of the goods, services, and capital, and to control problems like pollution and crime that occurred within its borders. But today, because of the ease of transportation, because of the ease of communication, because of globalization, it lies outside the power of most nation states to effectively regulate these new types of problems. And so what you've had is the rise, we argue, of a new kind of governance, global governance. And it has two features to it. One is that international agreements now try to regulate worldwide, that to effectively regulate something, international law has to have a scope that it didn't used to have. So, for example, to regulate chemical weapons worldwide, the Chemical Weapons Convention regulates the production and storage and existence of every kind of chemical in the world, no matter who possesses it. Even chemicals held by research laboratories, by industry, by private persons fall under the ambit of the Chemical Weapons Convention. So one thing you see is just broad scope that reaches well into a nation state in a way that international law did not before. The second thing is the rise of new kinds of international institutions that are neutral and independent from the control of any one country. In fact, they wouldn't be able to do their job unless they had those characteristics, because in order to effectively regulate and enforce these new kinds of international law, the institutions have to be seen as outside the control of any single country. And so you have the rise of things like not just the United Nations and the Security Council and the International Court of Justice, which I just mentioned, but things like the Chemical Weapons Convention, again, has a secretariat, or the World Trade Organization has new forms of courts and new forms of regulatory bodies that sit outside the control of any one country, but also have, because of that independence, a kind of power that international institutions didn't have before. It used to be, I think, fair to say that international institutions were more directly under the control of a few nations or some nations. Now they're seen as being independent of any nations. So just to give an example, if the United States and other countries in the world were ever to reach an agreement about global warming, it would have both of these characteristics. A global warming treaty, to be effective, would have to be able to reach into energy production and use in a country in ways maybe that the federal government today doesn't regulate here at home, even maybe to the extent of regulating domestic or home energy usage. At the same time, it would have to create an international institution that would have to decide how much each country was allowed to produce in terms of energy, how much pollution it was allowed to make, and also to measure whether people are in violation and to issue sanctions. And no one would trust that institution if it was directly under the control of the United States or of the European Union or of China. It would lose its legitimacy and its independent function, and the regime would not function unless you had an independent institution separate from the control of nation states. So I don't think we feel like these are particularly controversial descriptions of what's going on in the world. I think we're still at the early stages, but it's been going on and accelerating the last few years. And our view is that as globalization ties the United States and our economy and society tighter to the rest of the world, that you're going to see more and more of these kinds of agreements and institutions. The problem from our view is not that these are done at the international level. The question for us and the question for the book of Taming Globalization is, how does the United States political and legal system respond? Can the United States cooperate with these international institutions, these new kinds of regimes, and how does it do it? That's the fundamental tension and issue at the heart of the book. Because, as you can guess, maybe in my description, some of the new kinds of regulation and some of the new kinds of institutions are in tension with the way that the United States traditionally exercises public power, and particularly run into the prerogatives of Congress, especially over control of domestic law and things like taxation, but also the prerogatives of the executive branch and of the judiciary. To give one example, when a treaty regulates an issue, it is a standard doctrine, I think, amongst many scholars and many people who work in this area, that treaties are not limited by the same restrictions on behalf of federalism that apply to congressional statutes. So there was a famous case called Missouri versus Holland, where back in the 1920s it was thought that Congress could not regulate and protect species of birds for endangered species reasons. The court and the lower court struck down statutes that tried to protect birds. The United States then entered a treaty with Canada called the Migratory Bird Treaty, and then it was implemented by Congress in a law called the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, where Congress did exactly the same thing that the courts had said it could not do under its domestic powers. And in Missouri versus Holland, the Supreme Court said yes, the United States could do that, and the federal government's powers could be broader to regulate things domestically that it couldn't do via just a normal congressional statute. Another example would be in the area of the separation of powers. If the courts play the same role they play with international affairs as they would domestic affairs, I think the powers of the courts will grow. They'll be called into areas and matters which traditionally they haven't been involved with. But because international law and international regimes and these international institutions are affecting more and more things that used to be under the control of the national government or the states, it will by nature draw the courts into the kinds of delicate decisions about politics and foreign affairs that they used to try to stay out of. The overall tension, then, is between these new kinds of international cooperation, this new kind of institutions, which are a reasonable and understandable response to globalization, and the sort of traditional principles that had underlaid the United States Constitution and the separation of powers and federalism, and we think some deeper principles behind the Constitution, which I'll explain in a second. So Taming Globalization tries to produce a theory or an approach to solve this problem and then some specific solutions. And in fact, when we were thinking about it, it reminded us a lot about what happened during the New Deal period. And in fact, what we want to do is avoid what happened in the constitutional confrontation that occurred in the New Deal years. So one way to look at what happened in the New Deal period is that the economy nationalized. The markets were continent-wide, our society became more national, and yet the Constitution and the way we thought about it, the way the courts thought about it in particular, was still regional. So, for example, famously, the Supreme Court would only allow Congress to regulate a good when it crossed a state border, but it would not allow the Congress to regulate the manufacturing of that good or the sale of that good. Only when it crossed the border could Congress regulate it. The Supreme Court also blocked independent administrative agencies. It would not allow for the creation of neutral federal agencies to regulate things like communications or the railroads or the security markets. And so when the Great Depression occurred and President Roosevelt introduced approaches to governance at the domestic level, which are similar to what's being tried now at the international level, the Supreme Court blocked him for several years in the early 1930s. And constitutional law would not really come to accept the national scope of the economy and the national scope of Congress's powers until the famous confrontation between FDR and the Supreme Court in the beginning of President Roosevelt's second term. And it was only because President Roosevelt threatened to pack the court and the Supreme Court switched its positions on these questions of independent agencies and the powers of Congress, and effectively, after that point, allowed the federal government to regulate nationally and allowed the federal government to create independent institutions. It was only under the pressure of that kind of political attack that the constitutional tension was solved. And so one thing we hope is that in writing this book that we can see these issues coming down the road earlier than occurred in the 1930s, and hopefully figure out doctrines which will allow us to escape the same kind of confrontation that, in the end, I think did much harm both to President Roosevelt and the executive branch and to the Supreme Court and its independence. So how do we do that? One is that we think that the United States Constitution's basic structures for government, the separation of powers and federalism, should be maintained in the exact same way they apply domestically as they do to foreign affairs and things like treaties, international organizations, and international regimes. Because we think that those structures are an important aspect of what we call the Constitution's theory of popular sovereignty, the idea that the Constitution in our country and sovereignty and legitimacy in the government comes from the bottom up, not from the top down. That the Constitution is the contract between the people and the government, and that the government can only exercise power in the way that the people delegated to the federal government through the Constitution. And so the separation of powers and federalism are the two main restrictions and regulations of how the government can act. but that they can't be changed. We can't treat foreign affairs as a lacuna or a gap in those principles just because it involves foreign affairs or national security, that because the people through the Constitution only gave the national government the ability to act under those kinds of structures, they ought to apply equally to globalization or to domestic affairs. The second theory, the way that principle actually then can be implemented is that, one, the political branches, the branches that are elected, the President and Congress, should have the primary role for figuring out how to accept, implement, and enforce international law in our country rather than the courts. We think that Congress, including the House, should decide when international obligations, international institutions can have a direct effect in the United States, that the most democratically accountable branch of government should be involved whenever the federal government asks us as private individuals to change our behavior, change our legal status and relationships in response to an international agreement. We think this makes a lot of sense for democratic accountability reasons, because the most elected branches are the ones that are most accountable and the ones that are most transparent. We think it also makes a lot of sense for reasons of function, that the Congress and the President control the main resources of the country. They're in charge of conducting foreign affairs, and it makes the most sense, therefore, for the most capable branches of our government to be given the charge and responsibility for dealing with important weighty matters such as globalization and foreign affairs. And we think that it produces the least distortion to our constitutional structure. So no matter how you come out on where the President and Congress's powers should divide, no matter how you come out on where the federal government's powers versus the state government's powers should balance, our only argument is that that should be the exact same division and the exact same balance when it comes to globalization. Because if you do that, then globalization and the effort to respond to it doesn't distort the American political system. It doesn't distort our constitutional system. So let me close by just mentioning briefly some of the applications to discrete questions, and then I'd love to take your questions and comments and Judge Sofayer's questions and comments. First, one thing we propose is that the Supreme Court actually got things right in Medellin versus Texas, the case I mentioned at the beginning. That should be up to Congress to decide how the United States should live up to international agreements like the Vienna Convention right to see your consul. That the legislature is directly elected by the American people. We don't think that courts should try to implement agreements like that directly without the guidance of the most popular branch of government. And so we would say that treaties generally should not be considered automatically effective within our legal system until the President and the Congress have a chance to figure out how they should work in coherence with the rest of our legal system and these principles of federalism and the separation of powers. Second, we think that when it comes to the interpretation of international law and its enforcement, again, we think that the courts should try to reduce their role and that the President and Congress have an obligation and responsibility to enhance their role, that it should be up to, not just up to the President and Congress to do what they do, but that the courts should try to defer to the decisions of the Congress and the President. Again, that makes the decisions more democratic in deciding what types of international law and international regulation we're going to accept in our country. But we also think that makes it more transparent and accountable. So if people in the country think that the Supreme Court got things wrong in Medellin versus Texas and that we should stop death penalty executions in the country for aliens so that they can receive their rights to meet with their consulate, to have translators and so on, that they can demand their members of Congress to pass a statute to change that rule. If it's up to just the Supreme Court, there's really no way for people, the normal electorate, in a quick and speedy manner to make its views known and to have it effectuate in government policy. A third area we think is that the states should have a reinvigorated role in foreign affairs. And here I'd like to mention a case that's of particular interest to California. And it's a case called Garamendi. Remember, Garamendi was once, I think, the commissioner of insurance. This was a case where California in response to information that came out in the mid-90s that life insurance companies had not paid out insurance policies to Holocaust victims. California passed a law saying that, just the state of California passed a law saying that any insurance company that did business in California that had these policies should publish the information so that people could find whether these policies were due to their families and ask them to collect. It didn't try to order the insurance companies to collect. It just wanted more information produced. Remarkably, in our view, the Supreme Court struck down that law because it said it was inconsistent with federal policy about resolution of claims by Holocaust survivors. In our view, that went too far. In our view, that there should still be a space for states to act in matters involving foreign affairs and globalization. One point we think is quite right, we hope is quite right, we think is right, is that this is inevitable that states are going to play a big role because globalization means that a lot of things that which are in the primary control of the states, like crime, for example, as in the Medellin case, inevitably are going to affect foreign affairs and are going to be affected by foreign affairs. It's impossible to exclude the states these days from a voice and from regulation of foreign affairs because globalization means international affairs are everywhere around us now. A second thing is we also think the state should play a reinvigorated role because the states are more directly accountable and responsive to the citizens. States will react much faster and have better information or closer to the ground when it comes to government policy. And so that we think actually might lead to more effective and flexible foreign policy if we look to states to try to carry out some efforts to respond to globalization. So there, let me just close and sort of re-underline three basic reasons before I seek Judge Sofair's questions. I didn't mean to give you a promotion. Yeah, Judge Sofair's questions. One is we think that globalization should not result in a change in the basic way the American system makes its and enforces its laws. That the basic public lawmaking system, the basic structure of our government should remain intact and not change in response to globalization. Second, we think that as with domestic policy, most of these decisions should be reserved for the political branches, for the president and Congress, because they are the most accountable, because they are more transparent, and because they are most responsive to popular wishes. And third, we think that these solutions make sense because it's to the advantage of the United States in terms of the functional abilities of the branches of government, that the executive branch and the legislature have the ability to marshal society's resources and act more quickly and to set nationwide policies that are more rational than a single judge or a single set of courts, which tend to act more slowly, which tend to only see a small slice of a problem, and which have a difficulty in changing their course and point of view. And let me close by saying that in our view, this actually will lead to a more healthy American foreign policy, one that focuses on the real commitments that the United States makes and how best to live up to them rather than making promises which the country never keeps because Congress never steps up to pass the laws or because the president never appears to enforce international law. Instead, we leave things to the courts. So that, thank you very much for bearing with me. Thanks for braving the terrible weather we had in San Francisco today. And with that, I look forward to your questions and comments and those of Judge Sofair. Thank you.
I think, John, you have to stay up there.
Okay.
And I'll start off with a question of my own, and then I will I've arranged the questions from the audience in a way that we'll start with the most relevant to your book and work our way from there on. My first and most general comment and question relates to what I perceive to be an assumption on your part that globalization has caused a huge change in the way America operates that needs somehow to be constrained or we're in desperate trouble. And my perception of it is very different, that the ICJ has very limited powers, certainly no powers of enforcement, because we can block every ICJ decision in the Security Council that most everything is non-self-executing, as you recognize in the book, and that these sweeping claims about customary international law are just rejected. They're raised and pushed very emphatically, but mainly rejected by people because they just go beyond what really is customary international law. And that the global governance that really matters consists largely not of the political agencies in the UN, but of the specialized agencies, which operate in a very professional and objective manner, such as the International Maritime Organization, the International Civil Aviation Organization, the World Health Organization, the International Postal Union, organizations that have been around for, some of them, over 100 years, way before the UN even, and that these organizations operate in ways that are very consistent with a tremendous deference to sovereign powers of the state members by having either consensus requirements where any state, if a single state wants not to be part of some global system, they just opt out of a new rule or law that they adopt, and that the rules actually adopted in these organizations, and there are hundreds of them, like the International Maritime Organization, I know has had 75 treaties at least, in effect you could call them treaties, that have been adopted by them, are drafted by expert committees appointed by the individual national governments. So we have maritime experts from the U.S. and other places participating in these very professional operations, and out of which the U.S. could opt if it chose. So I'm reminded by your book, you know, this, the assumptions in your book of a very famous law professor from Harvard named Manly Hudson, who the international law community of America just goes wah-wah over. They just loved Hudson, and the American Society of International Law has named a prize after him called the Manly Hudson Prize. And Hudson went around the world before the first, right after the First World War, telling everyone that the world was going to be governed by a single government, essentially, that it was inevitable, everything was moving to the international sphere, there's an international bureaucracy being created. Just like some of the things you referred to more recently, Hudson was saying before the catastrophic Second World War and the whole destruction of the League of Nations, which he didn't predict at all. He thought the League of Nations was a huge success. And so I sort of suggest that I'd like to get your reaction to it, that maybe you've overstated the problem and that it isn't a matter of taming globalization as we have it, but avoiding globalization as some would have it, and as the and also of taming judicial overreach, which is a reality. I mean, that based on the last sections of your book. So that was my...
Yeah, that's a great question.
A little bit expansive.
No. The more the better. You never say no to a judge, current or former. First, I think you're quite right that the kind of global governance we're portraying has not been fully realized yet. That there isn't this global government in place now that regulates everything, and that there are international institutions everywhere on every subject. And I think the system you've described for many specialized areas would be fully acceptable with American constitutional system, where the United States would not be bound by anything unless it consented. Right? You have consensus rules in these specialized areas. And that you would wait on the President and Congress to fulfill the obligations rather than trying to make them directly enforced within the United States. So, but I think we're between there and full global governance. So I'll point out a few examples, and maybe I'd be curious to see what you think of them, too. So first, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta testified before Congress, I think last week, if not a week and a half ago. He was asked about whether the United States might consider intervening in Syria to help the rebels, just as the United States did in Libya, primarily, I think, with our Air Force, the Air Force, and supplying arms to the rebels. And Secretary Panetta said that the United States legally could not intervene in Syria because the UN Security Council had not authorized the operation, while as it did in Libya. And that, right, if you remember, the Obama administration, I believe, waited 3 weeks to get that UN Security Council authorization before intervening in Libya. And we have a debate we can always talk about whether Mr. Panetta was also correct when he said, but we also don't need Congress's permission, but we need the UN's permission. But there you have the Secretary of Defense, you know, publicly saying that we need the permission of one of these neutral, independent international organizations to give its approval before the United States can do something. Another one is the Alien Tort Statute litigation that's been going forward against American corporations. The Supreme Court has a case right now called the Coble case, where the question is if a foreign government violates international law in the treatment of its own citizens and allegedly does so to help make it easier for a corporation to run a refinery or build a mine or something, does that mean that the courts can directly interpret international law and then apply them? And then the third feature is the Supreme Court's recent use of foreign law, which I think we try to address at the end of the book, and is a really interesting, striking phenomenon, which is in several cases in the last few years, the United States Supreme Court has actually gone and looked at foreign law and international law and said that our interpretation of the Constitution is, in fact, some level guided by what the other countries in the world are doing, not because the international law has its own force. That was the case of Medellin, but just because things like due process, things like search and seizure, things like equal protection, we should interpret vaguer parts of our Constitution, taking into account what other countries do. I think that's a remarkable thing. And then last, I just read in the Wall Street Journal this week, the World Trade Organization, the last example of, you know, global governance being a little farther ahead, I think, than the old way, you know, the old sort of nation-state sovereignty model. The WTO just recently ruled that the United States illegally gave billions of dollars in subsidies to Boeing in the production of its latest airliner, the Dreamliner, and that the United States had to cease. And I believe the U.S. Trade Representative immediately said in response that the United States will react and that he expected Congress and the executive branch to take action to end the subsidies right away in compliance with the WTO judgment. So I don't think that the global governance we have now is as ineffective as the League of Nations were. Rather, I think it is exercising greater powers on more subjects. But I'd be the first to admit that we're not at the point where the UN's decisions take direct effect in the country, but we're farther along towards that. So our hope in the book is actually to identify something that we think is accelerating, and that before we take the plunge into it, that we pause and think about how do we make it consistent with our Constitution. But I'm curious to see what you think of those examples, if those are inconsistent with your view or are actually examples where we are farther along in global governance, perhaps.
Well, I'm not going to hog the time here. I have questions from the audience, and I'll get to that. I think your points are also legitimate. I don't think Panetta meant what he said. The alien tort law, I would just simply say, I think they haven't gotten around to what that law really was intended to do, and they eventually will, and that is that it doesn't apply abroad at all. It never was intended for that, as far as I read history, that it was intended to protect diplomats here from the torts and provide a remedy for them. And this Supreme Court's reliance on foreign law, I think they overdid it, and they've cut back. And I think that your comments and all the other comments will help on that. I think the WTO point is more in line with what we where our differences might be. Mm-hmm. The WTO has a provision, for example, I think it's Article 9, where the United States can simply invoke its national interests and avoid allowing the WTO to pass on any question. The only consequence of that is that reciprocity applies, as in all other international things. Other states can do the same thing. So states constrain themselves in using that power. But in terms of giving up our sovereign rights, we have there the ability to simply jerk something out of their hands if we don't want them to pass on it. Now, everyone knows Boeing has been subsidized, and so has the so have the European airlines. And what we're all trying to do is cut back on those subsidies. And the WTO itself doesn't have the power to order effectively a reduction in subsidies. The remedy that they, in effect, allow is a reciprocal punishment by the other states, the other affected states. Mm-hmm. So even there, there's sort of a respect still for the sovereign power of the state members. Mm-hmm. And I just think that your points are very good, and the overall book is good. I just think perhaps you don't give enough weight to the qualifications that people like you and I, because I was part of that draft, would draft into these institutions in order to avoid them running roughshod over American sovereign rights. So let me get to the first question here, and then you can actually comment, obviously, on anything I said. The one question I thought that was really very much a part of your book relates to the EU. And would you go into that a little bit? Is the EU another example of globalization, or is it more like a real federal government being formed? And what power should the EU have over the U.S.? All these rulings that are emerging from the EU antitrust division, all these things, is this also part of the globalization run amok kind of thing? And what's your reaction to that?
That's a great question. I wish we had thought of it and addressed it in the book. We didn't write unfortunately, we wrote the book before the current crisis in the European Union. If we'd written it a little later, the analogies you're pointing to would have really come to mind. And so whoever wrote that, this is a great question. I can't speak for my co-author, but I guess what I would say is I think the European Union is definitely a response to globalization, an earlier one, and it actually, in my mind, points to some of the perils that we're trying to identify. Because one of the main criticisms you hear about the European Union from Europeans is that there's a quote-unquote democracy deficit with the European Union. This is the phrase the Europeans came up with to describe the European Union's problems, is that much of the policy that's made over at the European Union doesn't come from any kind of proportional representation where an assembly votes on a new rule or a new standard. Instead, it's a system where a lot of the authority is vested in what's called the European Commission, which are essentially, as you said, the bureaucrats who set the standards for the European Union in a lot of areas, initially trade, but it's expanded to a lot of other areas now. And they make the judgments for the European Union about whether an American merger is a violation of antitrust, or what they would call competition law. And it's very difficult for the electorate in those countries to change the policies of the European Union. And you see that, I think, now the tension between a democratic constitution with accountability and transparency versus efforts to rely on independent, non-accountable officials to exercise sweeping powers as a response to globalization and its trends. You see that now, I think, in the problems that the European Union is having with regards to control the financial problem in their country, where you have decisions that are being made at the European Union level about how to handle the Greek debt problem and the ones that are coming down the road with Portugal and Spain and Italy in a way that's never put to any kind of popular vote in Europe. And you have enormous amounts of discontent in Europe where these sort of unelected officials are telling the people what the remedy is going to be for the financial problem. It might actually be against the wishes of their own populations. And so I guess one way to read what we're arguing is that we should not go down the European Union route. That doesn't mean it's impossible to cooperate. That's not possible to deal with globalization, but we have to do it consistent with our own constitutional and democratic values. But that part of the crack-up we're seeing in Europe, I would think, is because they didn't incorporate a more directly democratic element to the European Union. And now you see that with people in Germany now talking about not bailing out Greece anymore or the countries to come. And so it'll be interesting to see. I mean, nobody knows whether the European Union is going to survive this problem in the shape it is in now. But we would say one of the reasons, if it doesn't survive, one of the reasons it didn't was because it ousted democracy and transparency and accountability as the core principles of how the union should work.
Thank you. Another set of questions that you have seek to have your opinion on the United Nations. What do you think of the United Nations? How can it be strengthened in terms of creating a globalization that's more effective and more consistent with our constitutional system?
You know, I'd say the United States has a love-hate relationship with the United Nations. I mean, we were one of the countries that helped found it here in the city of San Francisco, where we're meeting tonight. At the same time, the United States has, I think, often in the area that the United Nations is perhaps most discussed in this country, has often used force abroad without the permission of the United Nations since its founding. If you remember, there's only been a handful of times that the United Nations has approved foreign conflicts, far short of the number of ones that the United States has actually been involved with since 1945. On the other hand, the United Nations does perform some very useful functions that sometimes I think we in the United States ignore when we criticize the United Nations for restricting the United States' ability to use force, or those of the NATO countries. So, for example, the United Nations is a useful forum for the conduct of diplomacy, as long as it doesn't try to bias or steer that diplomacy in a certain way. And sometimes I worry it does that with regard to the Palestinian-Israeli problem. But when it serves as a neutral forum where countries can come together and debate and try to reach a diplomatic solution, it performs a very powerful function. I also think that when the United Nations performs some of the specialized functions that you mentioned earlier in discrete areas, it can perform an important focus for the cooperation of countries for specific issues. So one should not, for example, understate the UN's achievements in the area of international health and food security and relief, education, and so on. Now, the question is whether all that needs to be done by the same institution. Does there need to be one United Nations that tries to be an umbrella that supervises all these other functions? Or, as some have suggested, whether it might be better for the UN to have to sort of decentralize into more discrete institutions, so they're not so that, for example, if the United States does not like the way the UN approaches the Israeli-Palestinian problem, or doesn't like the way the UN is attempting to restrict its ability to use force, that doesn't mean you have to also oppose the UN's very worthy achievements and efforts in the area of health and disease and relief. Unfortunately, and you worked on this much more directly than I did, when, say, Senator Jesse Helms cuts the dues of the United States to the UN because of dissatisfaction with the United Nations or the ICJ decisions on the U.S. helping the Nicaraguan Contras or something like that, you have the effect of harming a lot of things that the UN does that the United States would very much be in favor of. And so one way to solve that might be for the UN to devolve into several discrete institutions. Second thing I'll say about the UN, at least in my view, is that sometimes I think what the UN does is quite inconsistent with notions of justice or improving global welfare. This has been the work of mine in the last few months. I was very much struck by first the war in Kosovo and then the Libyan intervention. You may remember in the war in Kosovo, President Clinton led a coalition of countries to intervene to stop ethnic cleansing in the Balkans. The UN explicitly did not approve the intervention into Kosovo. I think looking back on it, most everyone would think that the intervention of the NATO coalition into the Balkans was a very good thing, both for the Balkans and for the world. But under international law, as many people currently interpret it, that the UN has to approve all uses of force in our self-defense, international law actually becomes a barrier, an obstacle to the achievement, I think, of improving the welfare of the peoples of the world. Now, one could reinterpret the UN Charter so it doesn't mean that, which some have, I think, tried to do, or it may be that the UN Security Council system is obsolete for the kind of challenges we have in the world, particularly when two of the five permanent members that can veto any use of force are authoritarian dictatorships, China and Russia, which often do not have an interest in allowing intervention to stop civil wars and terrible humanitarian disasters. The one example that I'm really left with is our failure to intervene in Rwanda, where a small detachment of American troops could have stopped, or European and United States troops could have stopped, a genocide that killed about 1 million people, and in part because the UN would not approve it.
Well, that's interesting to see that you are advocating a little bit more globalization in that area. And that, I just wanted to remind everyone that we're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is UC Berkeley Law Professor John Yu, who is discussing taming globalization and the issues related to globalization and law within the United States Constitution. There are a couple of relatively technical and I think very good questions, John, that I think are worth raising with you. And there is one general political one that I think, in fairness, we should raise, even though it isn't directly pertinent. Let me do the two short technical ones for you to handle. One is the impact of the voluntary compliance, which seems to be quite common now, where presidents simply avoid the political process by announcing that they're going to voluntarily comply with some international treaty or international agreement. And the other is, are you really serious about giving states this veto in the absence of federal legislation overriding them? Don't you think that will interfere with the effective implementation of perfectly democratically obtained rules?
Those are both excellent questions. The first one about voluntary compliance, it's not something we address in the book, but I published an op-ed with John Bolton in the New York Times last Friday about this. It's a really, I think, a growing phenomenon where presidents who feel that Senate approval of an international agreement or it's very hard to get congressional implementation of an agreement instead say that the United States will voluntarily comply with some kind of treaty or international agreement but not submit it to the Senate or to the Congress. And this is done by presidents of both parties. So in the piece we noted, for example, that President Obama is doing that right now with a European-led effort to create an arms control regime for outer space. President Bush, I think, did the same thing with regard to some of the agreements with Iraq, particularly with basing rights and how many troops would be left. President Clinton did it with the ABM Treaty. After the Soviet Union went out of existence, President Clinton said that the United States would still comply with the ABM Treaty, even though the other country we signed the treaty with went out of existence. So this is something that has happened, but I think it's starting to happen more and more. In part, I think, of a political reaction to the Senate being more difficult, perhaps, and slower in making international agreements. The problem we have with it is that at some point, a president who says the United States is just going to act a certain way that happens to cooperate with other countries can lead into a binding commitment that we think ought to be one that is submitted to the Senate. And that could, we can argue, and in the piece we were not defining clear line yet about where that was. But we want people to be aware that that presidents who do this may start to intrude into then some of the things we're talking about in the book, that wanting to have some kind of directly accountable and transparent democratic means for approving international agreements that we're going to implement. So, for example, we just don't think presidents can avoid that whole process just by saying, I'm going to do everything as if we had signed a treaty, but I'm just not going to put my signature on it. That's too formalist an evasion of this constitutional system that's set up. But I agree with you. It's a very hard question at the margin to say, when does this unilateral presidential action become an agreement that should be submitted to the Senate or submitted to the Congress? The second question is, I guess I am serious in the book. It wasn't a trick to say that we think that the states should have a greater role in foreign affairs. In part, I think this is inevitable because, for example, the Medellin case itself, because of the ease of movement into the country with aliens coming in and out of the country, aliens are going to commit crimes within the United States just like citizens do, and they're going to come into contact with the criminal justice system. It's probably impossible for the federal government to create a rule for a separate criminal code, as it were, for aliens on the one hand when the states regulate crime for everybody else. The federal government doesn't have the resources to enforce that kind of law. It doesn't have the ability, I think, to make all the decisions that would be involved. I mean, think about the decisions about how you would define a crime that would be consistent throughout the country when the states had different ones. So one thing is just that it's inevitable because of globalization that states have to regulate foreign affairs. There's no way to escape it. So we think that unless the federal government intervenes and actually passes a law or there's a judicial decision or some other lawful exercise of federal power, you have to default to something. And so one thing that troubled us when we were writing the book is that you have a lot of scholars and international lawyers who argue that, no, you shouldn't just use the background state rule. Federal courts should make up their own rule, that this is a gap in our constitutional system, and since the system doesn't address it, courts should feel free to develop their own answer. And we think that has a lot of problems in terms of democratic legitimacy. So at least if the federal government has not acted, then one should default and let the states regulate. So, for example, the case of Garamendi itself, where the federal government had not yet issued any kind of law, had not reached any kind of binding internal rule about the right of private citizens to get information about the insurance policies that were not paid out during the Holocaust period. I think that's something that states should be able to do because states already, like California, heavily regulate the insurance industry. They're going to regulate insurance whether the federal government does it or not. Why shouldn't it be able to regulate things involving Holocaust victims when those insurance companies want to do business in California, whether they're Boston Insurance Company or a German insurance company?
Now, I want to ask this question for the audience because there are so many of them who want to know your view of executive power. I know it isn't directly related to what you've been talking about and what you analyze in the book, but it is part of it. And they really do, many of the people in the audience, would like to have your perception of executive power. What is the role of the president in all these issues?
Yeah. Thanks, Edmund. I know you and I have an academic debate between ourselves about the role of the executive in war.
We do. It's yes. One of the few areas where we disagree.
I don't want to make it a secret. I mean, one of the books that most influenced me when I did my own work on war powers was your book on war powers. Judge Sofair has the view that Congress should authorize offensive use. Stop me if I mischaracterize, but I think that your argument is that Congress must authorize offensive uses of force.
Well, it's that when Congress does say the president cannot do something,
right. He cannot
do it.
Yes.
That the president does not have the power to disregard an affirmative act of Congress. Yes.
So, my view, it's not a secret on executive power. It does have some influence on the themes in this book, but it's, as you say, it's not a core issue. Is that I think the Constitution created the presidency to actually play a larger role when it comes to foreign affairs and national security, that actually the role that we most associate with the president today, this political leader and the head of the government and the setter of policies, is something that the framers actually would not have expected for domestic policy. They thought that president would play that role in foreign policy, not because the president would have a unique claim to it, but they gave it to the president because the executive branch is best structured to do that. So that's why the presidency is one person. There were proposals and there were state examples where the executive branch was multiple people. But the framers thought the president ought to be one person because that would mean the executive branch could act swiftly and quickly. They understood that that meant the president might make more mistakes, right? When one person decides rather than two, they understood that could lead to more mistakes and errors. But they thought the balance was better to act with speed and swiftness and secrecy and decision, as the Federalist Papers called it. However, I think that this is a power that really is directed abroad and at threats from abroad, and that it fluctuates so that in periods of our history when we don't have a significant threat, when the United States is not heavily involved in foreign affairs, to me it seems that the president's constitutional powers recede, and they have historically receded during those times. But when there's emergencies and crises like the Civil War or the 9/11 attacks, or World War I and World War II, then you do see a big expansion in the executive branch. But I think that's in keeping with the framers' original design, that that's why they wanted to have the executive branch at all. One of the major defects of the Constitution before our Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, is that it didn't have that kind of single executive who could respond quickly to a crisis. And then after time, either if the emergency crisis goes away or becomes more stabilized, there is an ample space for Congress to act and the courts to get involved. And I think we've seen that in the last 10, 11 years now.
Well, if the audience is interested in following up on that, they can. I wanted to end with one question that I think will give you a chance to go to the heart of some of your arguments. And that is, if the Constitution itself provides for a treaty power and a process whereby treaties are passed and adopted, and then reserves to the House of Representatives the power to fund things, and most of these treaties have to be enforced through legislation, why isn't that a sufficient constitutional structure to justify treaty making and globalization through treaty making?
I quite agree with that, actually. I think that's if that were the system that worked going forward with responses to globalization, I would be quite happy. So the idea would be the United States can sign treaties, it can make what agreements it wishes as part of this effort to respond to globalization, but the House still retains this fundamental check of the power of the purse and the power of legislation. The problem, I think, is that you see efforts to go, and let me say, that's the system that seems to me to have worked in this country for almost 200 years. It's still, that reserves in the most directly elected branch, the most accountable branch that we vote for every 2 years, the primary responsibility to deal with these issues. And if we don't like what they do, we can quickly and easily vote them out of office. The problem, to me anyway, is that in these responses to globalization, in the kinds of things we're talking about with the first question, what's really happening, you see efforts to go around or evade that structure. You know, so the Supreme Court using foreign law or international law to interpret the due process clause, right? The House is not involved. Right? The use of the Alien Tort Statute to hold American companies or foreign companies accountable for the actions of foreign governments. Also, the House is sidestepped. So the worry I have is that the system that we are developing to deal with globalization, promoted by use of international institutions and these broad treaties, is actually trying to figure out ways to get around that structure. That goes back to your question, this excellent question about the European Union. That's the problem we have with the European Union, I think, today, is that the check of the most democratic branches in these governments is excluded when it comes to the actions of the European Union. And so maybe I can close by saying, I think that what's happening in Europe now should be a warning to us in the United States of a way to pursue these questions that might contain the seeds of a disaster. Thank you very much.
Well, let me just say our thanks to John Yoo, professor at UC Berkeley Law School and co-author of this new book, which I strongly recommend. It's beautifully analyzed. It's full of very, very useful information, Taming Globalization, International Law, the U.S. Constitution, and the New World Order. We will also thank our audiences here and on television, radio, and the Internet. I'm Abe Sofair, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place you're in the know, is adjourned.